Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Christine LaPerriere, and welcome to Leader in Motion Radio. Today, I'm really excited. I have Bill Cumming on. It's kind of neat. I can tell you more about Bill Cumming. It's really, really long list of accomplishments, but the thing that I think is neat is I saw him recently in a workshop where he talked about the power of loving kindness. And for me, it was just transformative. So it seems to me that that Bill Cumming, no matter how I introduce him, it simply won't really set him up properly. But I'll give it a shot. He's got a 30-year career in coaching, consulting, trainer for CEOs and executive teams. He's worked in businesses, school systems, non-for-profits. He's also got a organization called the Boothby Institute. One of the things that I think is kind of neat is when you look up the Boothby Institute, their opening line, "We are a nonprofit organization created to provide people the opportunity to experience ownership and responsibility in a climate of empathy and loving kindness." And I just think that that one line kind of explains exactly what happened for me when I had the opportunity to work with Bill. So with that, Bill, I'm going to invite you on to say hello.
Hi, Christine.
Hi, Bill. I all of a sudden I got really nervous and started to stutter there. I thought, how do I actually introduce Bill? Because that experience that I had at the workshop that you did for Supercoach was just so profound that I kind of got a loss for words.
Well, this is Bill is actually my preference. Whatever story is important today, we'll get into that. But when you tell people the background, that's all well and good, but it puts them into their mind. It has them go back in their experience of what they think certain things are connected to. So I really am serious. This is Bill is my favorite introduction, and then we'll go from there.
That's great, then. This is Bill.
Thanks.
That's my introduction today for you.
That's great. Well, the thing that when we were talking before the show that I want to see where I can put my finger on and open up a bit, my experience came actually from business. Yes, I've been a teacher and a Y director. I ran a foundation. But I was also corporate responsibility officer for what is now KeyBank nationally. And it was at that time that one of my children was raped. And I always fast forward to 2012. That young woman is now an accountant with a practice in Boston and the commander of her VFW post, Veterans of Foreign Wars. I'm very prejudiced in her behalf. But it was that event that allowed me to look at where damage and negative things come from in the world. Well, that's just not about physical violence and damage and things like that. It's about the kind of damage that creates the defalcation of huge amounts of very poor investments in the investment community by a whole bunch of people who went to Harvard, Yale, et cetera, and I didn't mean to pick on the two of them, but prestigious colleges and universities, and that was about greed. So how does that happen? Well, in my experience, the way it happens is that people grow up not feeling very well about themselves. They may have all the trappings and all the money, but they really don't feel well about themselves. And unless that happens, they're going to do things that are inappropriate. You can't legislate morality. You can't correct people into wellness. They have to experience it, and it is a very personal kind of thing. It's not something you can write a book about and expect it to do any good. It has to be given from one human being to another. And again, if I may, Christine, for a second, I want to go back to that event in 1979. Obviously, the first thing we did was to take care of my daughter. And the second thing we had to do was we had to figure out what we were going to do with an old man that was so angry he couldn't see straight. I was livid. I would have killed that man if I'd caught him that day. And so I had to look at my own violent reaction to that, and I tried to spend my life doing things that I thought were worthwhile. But as I began to look at both of those things, and I also had some experience with people who had moved from violence to now they were constructive citizens, as I began to understand how they'd done that, I began to find that there was a single unifying principle that existed that allows people to move from unwellness or insecurity and fear to a sense of groundedness and well-being. And that experience involves two things. It involves, first of all, a person experiencing that they're loved absolutely and without condition. And that means no matter what you do, I'm going to continue to love you. Does not mean I'll tolerate inappropriate behavior. Doesn't mean I'll like everything you do. Doesn't mean that we'll agree about everything. But it does mean I'll hold you in absolute high regard. And secondly, a person has to experience that their value and worth in the world is a given. We in our society, certainly in Western cultures, but obviously not just in Western cultures, given the facts that a bunch of monks were just caught, you know, gambling and drinking in some hotel in Korea, Buddhist monks. The Buddha's not happy about that, by the way.
Right.
The fact,
he's pretty upset.
The fact of the matter is that if people don't have a sense of their value and worth and expect to get it from their position, they don't serve people well. I was once told that the CEO of an organization would sell his grandmother, and the person who was telling me meant it. He said if the price was right, he'd sell his grandmother. We've all experienced people who do things that are inappropriate. The reason they do that is they don't value themselves. So as people grow in their sense of value and worth in the world, which is not about getting the campfire benches out and singing Kumbaya, it's quite pragmatic, it's quite practical, and when people become able to experience their own wellness, then that's the only thing they want to surround themselves with. And so corporations that develop that climate, generally speaking, are healthier and also more productive and therefore more profitable.
So Bill, I love what you just said. Help me understand. I'm trying to picture in my mind, having experienced corporate world, how do you help people in the corporate world access their well-being and that loving kindness? I it's just hard for me to picture how you can create that transformation.
Well, first of all, I'll be quite candid with you. There's not a line of people tripping down my door to have that conversation. However, the people with whom we've had it have been dramatically inspired about what they've experienced. We have an insurance agent who we've done a lot of work with recently, and he now really realizes that his job as an agent is actually to be interested in the lives of the people who are his customers. And since he's moved to a place where that's what he does, he doesn't call and wish people a happy birthday and then try to sell them something. He genuinely calls to thank them for being on the planet and wishes them happy birthday. So the people actually get that the reason he's calling is not to do something else. Okay? It's
right.
Not a technique. In this particular case, I'm not even sure I can remember exactly what the statistics are, but in the last year and a half, he's done 10 times greater sales in sales of mutual funds, and we're talking millions here. We're not talking nickels and dimes, because he stopped selling people. He stopped giving them a hard sell. He actually became genuinely interested in their well-being. So the answer to the question is one person at a time. It's absolutely critical if you can get the CEO on board for the conversation. Therefore, working with smaller companies is oftentimes easier than working with a big company. But by the same token, this particular agent and a few others that we've been working with are now, we're going to take another conversation to the chief operating officer of that company and see whether we can have an impact there. It only can work one person at a time, Christine, and it has to be personal. First of all, there's no model for it. There are a few people who have been talking about this kind of thing for a long time, and most of them were, you know, successful in one part of their lives, but the loving kindness piece got dropped out. Ed Deming is a name. Is that name familiar to you, Christine?
No, not actually.
Okay, not surprising. It's you have to be older.
I will work on that.
Yeah, well, you're fine. Ed Deming was head of quality control for the Allied forces during World War II. And he came back to the United States and started talking to people about producing quality and giving people dignity and respect, and nobody wanted to listen to him. You'd never guess where he went. Take a guess.
To the prisons.
No, he went to Japan. When Ed Deming went to Japan, Japan was known for little ruffled umbrellas that went in cocktail drinks. Anything that was made there was considered to be basically unreliable and certainly not long-lasting. I don't think that's what happened when Ed got finished. He worked with a few companies that might ring a bell: Toyota, Sony, Mitsubishi, etc. Now, the only company that Ed ever came back and worked with is Ford. Interestingly enough, the only one who didn't take any of the bailout money and who really started building the quality and appealing models that are now have put them back in business in pretty good shape. The point I'm making here is Ed Deming said, if you want to find out how to have the assembly line work well, talk to the people on the assembly line. All right? Involve the people. Actually, if you ask somebody their opinion, listen to it. Oftentimes I hear people saying, well, I wish my people could be more creative. If you want your people to be creative, you have to listen to all their ideas, the good ones and the ones that aren't so wonderful, and truly thank them for their ideas, whether they are agreeing with you or not. Oftentimes we're looking for good ideas that agree with us, and you can't do that. It has to be across the board, which really is about holding people in ultimate high regard. But I want to go back and answer the more important question, which you asked, is how do you get into a conversation like this at a corporate level? Well, one of the first things you have to do is look for companies that are dealing with a problem. Okay, they've got an issue that they're dealing with. I'll give you one of my favorites because it's the way I got my job at what is now KeyBank nationally. There was a regional bank in Ohio, very strong bank. It was called Cleveland Trust. And it was the 14th largest bank in the United States. Even when it was purely a Northeast Ohio bank, it was a big bank. The George Gunn family had whole kinds of assets there, et cetera. But the bank was poorly viewed by the community. The mayor of the city of Cleveland at the time was a guy named Dennis Kucinich, who's just lost his bid for reelection to the House of Representatives. And interestingly enough, he's done some very interesting things since then, but at the time he was so anti-business, all he did was make the Cleveland Trust Company the whipping boy for everything that didn't work in the city of Cleveland. Now, in my opinion, the thing he's done that's brilliant is starting the Department of Peace. If we're going to find solutions to and alternatives to military engagement, we need to be talking about what the solutions can be. It's a brilliant idea and it needs to be supported. All of that notwithstanding, in Cleveland, Dennis Kucinich was just abhorred by the business community. To make a long story short, the bank was foreclosing on some school system loans that the city had defaulted on, and I knew the guy who ran Kucinich's office, and he and I had known each other for a long time. So I called him up and I said, get a few of the key leaders. I'll get a few of the board members of the bank. We'll sit down and have a meeting, and we'll figure out how to solve this problem. Well, at about 3:30 in the afternoon, I got a call from the chairman of the bank saying my last name and some expletives connected to it. And he said, what the heck do you think you're doing? Don't you think I'm smart enough to solve this problem? And I said, no, sir, I was just trying to avoid the city schools being in trouble and having the kids pay the price. He said, if I wanted a solution to this problem, I would have done it months ago. I want that idiot to look like a fool. I don't ever want him to be reelected. And I thought to myself, that's a pretty interesting circumstance. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
It was a very negative thing. But the way I got the job was actually offering to go into the bank and train their 800 top officers to be effective board members of nonprofit organizations. I developed a program called Trustee Effectiveness Training. And so I went in and trained all their officers in boardsmanship, and then they went and became board members of a lot of nonprofit organizations, and it really helped the image of the bank. Unfortunately, I happened to find out that we got a lot of complaints about not loaning money in the inner cities. So I went downtown and asked the people back at the head office to give me a comparison of loans to deposit by zip code. And the person said something to me that my father always warned me about in business. He said, you have to listen carefully to what people said. He said, we don't keep the information that way. And I said, well, how do you keep it? And he said, well, we keep it by loan number. And I said, and by address? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do you keep deposits? Well, by deposit number. And I said, and address? Yeah. Okay, good. Print down all the addresses for one zip code for the loans and for the deposits, and let's take a look at it. Well, what we found is that the bank was redlining terribly. And because I discovered this, we created one of the most aggressive inner-city loan programs in the history of American banking, thanks to Bob Miller, who was the chief marketing guy at the bank at that time. Well, the fact of the matter is we started in on very pragmatic problems, but we certainly did get to the issue of loving kindness and treating people appropriately when you're starting to talk about redlining in neighborhoods. They go hand in hand. You're either going to operate an ethical store or you're not. I do have more stories. I better be quiet, let you ask another question.
Well, no, it's just fascinating. So I love these stories where help give us some more examples. I know you did some work with, I think, in the prison space, right?
I did, yeah.
You talked about bringing loving kindness into that world, which just fascinated me because it's counterintuitive.
Well, the problem is that the way prisons are run in this country is counterintuitive. You want to look at the most successful program in the United States. It's called Delancey Street. And it's run by a gal who's put her entire life into it, and they've got programs now in 3 states. That is a program about ownership, responsibility, and treating people with dignity, grace, and loving kindness, period. It's a tough program. You have to do what you say. But it is a place where you are going to be respected. The director of the program, the person who's put millions of dollars of her own into this program, she happened to come from means, so she was able to do that. But the fact of the matter is, there are models for it. The only programs that have ever been effective having to do with rehabilitation have to do with ownership, responsibility, and loving kindness. Now, the work that we did was a 12-week program, 3 hours a week, 1 day a week, working with 25 inmates, no cameras, no microphones, no nothing, me and 25 inmates. And what I do is basically talk with them about their value and worth in the world for a while. And then we start talking about the power that resides inside of them. So let me give you, again, my favorite example from this. One of the things we ask people to do is pick a chore they don't like doing. So in the prison, the immediate thing they say is, well, you can't possibly ask us to do that stuff. Do you know what we get to do some of the times? And I said, no. I said, I can imagine, but I don't know. And they said, well, we get to clean up bathrooms that have been used as a communication space, and the method of communication happens to include human waste. And I have a pretty graphic picture in my mind of what that's like. And the inmate is saying, we can't possibly do that. And then we go away for a week. And one of them comes back and says, you know that job that I said I couldn't do? I found out I still hate it. I still hate that it happens, but I was able to do it twice as fast because I wasn't always complaining about it. I just got it done. Well, if you can figure out that you can do that job with energy, enthusiasm, and as if it were the most important job in the world, almost anything else you're going to have to do when you get out on the street is going to work, because people are going to know that you actually went there with the intention of getting the job done. And then I'll give you a couple of other examples. One of the things they say, well, we can never get a job because we have to disclose that we've been in prison. And this is the state penitentiary. This isn't some local county jail, by the way. And I said, well, how many times have you offered to put in a day's work for nothing? And not a person in that room had ever thought about that. All right. What they discover is that once they are operating with somebody who respects them, that they will begin testing these things out. And I'll give you the most dramatic extreme of this. One of the things we do is ask people to pick a case study, somebody who they know, a family member, or somebody they believe is headed for a train wreck. And the communication is that you care, you love that person. Use whatever word you want. We're not stuck on the vocabulary. But you care about that person, and that they have an opportunity to do something that allows them to demonstrate that they can take charge of their own lives, like keep their agreements or whatever. Well, about 6 weeks into this program, one of the guys raises his hand, and he's the biggest guy in the room. He's about 6 feet 6 inches tall. I don't know how long he'd been in prison, but the one thing I know is he never missed an opportunity to go to the weight room. He was huge. I'm a big guy. He could have bench pressed me all day and never noticed it. It would have been amazing.
Right.
He said, "Get over here. I want to talk to you because I just figured out that you want us to do exactly the same thing with these pedophiles that you want us to do with our case studies." And I said, "Well, let's take a look at what you do. What do you think, by the way, that I think about the behavior of a pedophile?" And he said, "You probably don't like it." I said, "You're right. I don't like it. I hate it. It's why I do this work. But here's what I see you doing. You know somebody's done damage, and especially damage to children. So what you do is do more damage to them, so for sure they're going to go out and do it again. So from my point of view, when they go out and do it again, you've got a little ownership of that, too. That's how I view it." Well, having put those words out there rather quickly, the thought also crossed my mind that I might become the newest pile driver on that cement floor, because I wasn't sure how he was going to respond to this. And as he sat down, he said, "I don't have to like this, do I?" And he sat down. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not asking anybody to like inappropriate behavior. What I'm suggesting is, if we treat people appropriately, it's amazing how they respond. You can't correct people into wellness. That's why prisons don't work, because they're an attempt to punish people. Well, we've already got people who don't feel well about themselves, so now we're going to go punish them some more. Doesn't make sense at all.
Absolutely. That damage coming from damage example that you just gave to me is just, it's astounding. All of a sudden, when you really stop and think about how in our own lives, maybe not even an example of a prison in a pedophile situation, but even our day-to-day examples of damage coming from damage, right? A child does something wrong and we spank them, you know what I mean, or we punish them. Or if you think of in the corporate world, it's like, you know, somebody can mess something up really bad, and next thing you know, everybody's standing around kind of criticizing them and pointing fingers and placing blame, and, you know, it's that damage comes from damage. So how do we ever... It's pretty profound to think that the idea of loved without condition could
mm-hmm.
exist in those kind of spaces.
Well, the thing you're talking about, everybody talking about that person, if you want to improve the morale in your corporation, have a conversation about stopping third-party conversations. If
yes.
you've got a problem with somebody, who do you talk to first? The person who it involves. If that doesn't resolve it, you tell them that you're not resolved with it, and you're going to talk to them and their supervisor about whatever the situation is. But you have the conversation in front of people. Anytime you talk about people behind their back, there's only one reason that's done. That's to feel a little bit better than the other person, because we got to have somebody to dump on, you know. If I'm well, I don't speak disparagingly of other people. And by the way, this isn't just important in terms of corporations. It's important in terms of politics. Right at the moment, we're at risk of losing a democracy because we don't treat people well. It used to be that the leaders of the various parties would argue tooth and nail in public, and then they'd go socialize and be civil with one another in other environments. That doesn't happen anymore. This is cutthroat now. We're always looking for the jugular, about one thing or another. And unless we learn to talk with people and respect the differences of opinions, we're at risk of losing the democracy, because then it becomes just about power, not being able to talk reasonably through solutions. And unfortunately, we keep constantly going to things that are destructive to people and not constructive. So we've got an uphill battle here, but there's only one thing you can do, and that's one person at a time. And once you've decided to do this, by the way,
mm-hmm.
you don't really worry too much about what other people are going to think or say. I'm not a naive person. I know when I'm taking risks and things like that. But if I've decided this is the way I'm going to live my life, all of a sudden you get to be at peace, and you know it's going to work out ultimately, because unfortunately, another misnomer, we talk a lot about security. Security is an illusion. If that financial crisis that we just went through for the last few years had gotten just a little bit worse, the entire economic framework of the world economy could have gone down the tubes. And by the way, we're much more vulnerable right at the moment, because it used to be that all the trades, transactions in world trades, were made with dollars. That's not true anymore. Deals are made in all kinds of different currencies. So we've got our little special deal is pretty much gone. We got to be competing with everybody else, and there's this leveling off period. Well, the fact of the matter is that unless we learn how to operate with integrity, what we're going to do is continue to create situations and circumstances where we do things that are inappropriate and unethical. And as we do that, we're not going to be able to, in my opinion, sustain the kind of economies that we want to sustain. This has to be good for everybody, and it's possible to do that, but we keep talking about it as if it were about scarcity.
Right, and I think that anything driven out of fear or scarcity obviously is in direct conflict with understanding how to love other people and, you know, unconditionally, and actually bringing that value and worth. I can see that, because even in, you know, in politics, or, you know, particularly in the media, even that idea of, you know, loving without condition and bringing forth that everybody has value and worth is counterintuitive to operating out of scarcity or fear or profitability.
Yes. Unfortunately, right at the moment, you talk about the entertainment business. Right at the moment, we've got a lot of demonstrations of unwellness, but we don't have very many people having conversations about the solution. I'm,
right,
as I said, a pragmatist. I'm, you know, do I think this is important so that we don't have any more kind of damage that happened in my family? You bet. But the fact of the matter is, I'm talking about global economies and everything else. You don't create workability and peace simultaneously unless you're going to operate with integrity. People have to know that you're going to keep your word. Loving kindness is assumed to be about this euphoric kind of, as I said before, we gather the benches around the fireside and start singing Kumbaya. No, this is about people feeling really well about themselves, respected, treated with dignity. But now we're going to really have to bust our chops here to produce the result. We're not going to have just conversations about doing it the easy way. We're going to have to find ways so that everybody discovers that security is not about money. Security is about knowing that you can recreate whatever you need to. One of my favorite questions to people is, if you were dropped into a third world country where you didn't know a person, would you be okay? Are you going to be all right? If you know that you can do that, you're probably going to be all right in any environment you're in. But there's only one way you can do that, and that's by being respectful and treating other people well. You cannot operate with a kind of arrogance that where people want to resist you.
So, Bill, this is excellent. And I know we could get into some, I just have a number of topics that I'd love to explore with you, but we're just coming to the last 2 minutes of our short show. So I'm going to ask you, if every single person walked away from this show and took one action item, just one, mm-hmm, what would you suggest that that be?
I suggest that they look at people and recognize that every other person on the planet wants things to work for them too, and that they begin to separate people from their behaviors. There's not a person who doesn't want their children and grandchildren to thrive. Is there anybody who really wants to offer up their children as a way to end the problems in the world? I don't think so. So recognize that people, the value of people, is not about their actions, and recognize that the only reason people are doing things that are damaging, destructive, all of those things, is because they don't feel well about themselves. Just the knowledge of that makes a great deal of difference. And in that regard, treat as many people as you can with dignity and grace and loving kindness, and it will have a profound impact on your family, on everybody else around you, which does not mean being a pushover.
I love that message. Thank you so much, Bill. I would encourage everybody to, I'll actually say, Google Bill Cumming or the Booth B Institute. There's lots of great stuff out there. I think Bill also is participating in a TEDx event here pretty soon. Is that right,
yes,
Bill?
Yep, on Saturday. Yep.
Great, on
great.
Saturday. So there's lots of great information that you can find out about him. He's also done a lot of writing and things like that. So I'll suggest that everybody Google Bill Cumming, what one person can do, or the Boothby Institute and learn more about all of the excellent work that he is doing in the world. Thank you so much, Bill. Namaste. I appreciate it so much.
Namaste, Christine. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Have a good night. Bye-bye.